It's 50 years since the young Tom Stoppard's astonishing play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, made his name at the Old Vic, then the home of Olivier's National Theatre. The comic, playful, Beckettian study of two courtiers on the fringes of Shakespeare's Hamlet is now enjoying an anniversary revival at the same theatre, directed by David Laveau, a regular Stoppard collaborator, with Daniel Radcliffe and Joshua Maguire as the confused courtiers and David Haig as the player. David Laveau has directed a wide range of theatre and opera productions in Britain and America, including several other Stoppard plays, Jumpers, Arcadia, and The Real Thing, which won a Tony Award. He joins me, Heather Neal, now at the Old Vic, where Rosencrantz and Guildenstern has been greeted with much pleasure and 4-star reviews, to talk to Theatre Voice. Thank you very much, David. You must be very much on Stoppard's wavelength. You've worked with him a number of times, haven't you?
I have. This is the fourth play that I've worked together with Tom on. And not that I would claim to be on his wavelength. I'm not sure anybody's on Tom's wavelength exactly. But luckily, I think we sort of intersect from time to time. But it's true that, in a way, I'm pleased to not have come to his first play, as it were, without having had the experience of some of the other later plays first.
Oh, why do you say that?
Because I think Stoppard is very, his plays are very deceptive at some level, because in terms of staging them, because on the surfaces, of course, they appear to be all facility and verbal dexterity and all the, you know, dazzling things that that Stoppard is known for. But what's very elusive and sometimes hard to get at is what I sort of call the undertow of the plays, where something way beyond words is bubbling up. And bubbling up to the surface, in the case of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, despite the fact that it's clearly, you know, a young man's play, the presence and the preoccupation with mortality is the dimension that, you know, in my view, makes it great theatre. And knowing from The Real Thing and Arcadia and Jumpers this almost signature quality that Tom's plays have of a kind of poised silence that sometimes is you know, prepared to almost overwhelm language, is something that became very important in approaching this play. Mm-hmm. And this play, particularly because it was, as it were, his calling card originally, you know, was initially received as an incredibly sort of dazzling jest, you know, a brilliantly executed idea. And for a long time, I think critics didn't generally see Tom in terms of his emotional content. And that has only...
Yes, not until Arcadia.
Not until Arcadia. But I really think it's a bit of an artificial distinction between the early plays being, you know, Head and Heart, and then Heart entering in from Arcadia, etc. It's a sort of convenient and rather phony thing. It's just that in the earlier plays, because they are so structurally ambitious, you know, like Travesties, which I saw last night, is so extraordinary, that, you know, the presumption is that out of that formal magic, there must be less about human emotions, but actually, really, that's quite untrue. Mm. It'd be like saying cubism doesn't convey emotion, you know.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you about that. When it was first seen here, it was such an enormous surprise. Mm. I mean, and now, of course, everyone knows what to expect, so you don't have that element, and people might even come to it or leave it saying, you know, it's a bit long-winded now. So you had to bear all that in mind, I suppose.
Well, you know, Tom said very early on, when this idea of, you know, a 50th anniversary production at the Old Vic, where the play had first started, you know, once that idea was raised, you know, of course, Tom's immediate reaction was, God, wouldn't it be awful if we just sort of got it off, got it up and sort of dusted it off like an old opera production? And clearly, that couldn't be our intention. My way of looking at it and what I shared with the company was, and with Tom, was to say, you know, it's a moment to renew the contract between the player and its audience. And certain things did change in the course of rehearsal. Tom wanted to add a bit more Shakespeare, for instance, so that the, as it were, the ticking clock of Shakespeare's Hamlet on its various stages throughout Tom's play became a little bit more coherent and clear. And there were other details, but in the end, you know, I find it very gratifying that there's a young as well as an older audience coming to this play, and I think for many of them it may well be their first experience of the play, or indeed of Stoppard. In some cases, possibly their first sort of contact with Shakespeare in any form.
Drawn by Daniel and
absolutely
Harry
yes.
Potter.
Yes, which is not obviously the sole reason for casting Daniel Radcliffe, because that came about for other reasons, but it's turned out to be a very energetic sort of confluence of interests, you know, transgenerational, as it were. And that's very pleasing. And you know, as you say, there's always this, it was not a fear I had, but I can imagine, you know, an anxiety in a writer thinking, well, you know, is my play going to be ultimately judged as a relic now? My sense of it, and these audiences here with the play, and indeed this cast, are that it's got, you know, it's good to go for another 50 years.
Yes. Well, it's all interesting too what you said about death, because obviously it is there in the play throughout, and it's even in the title, so the audience knows
yes.
that they're going to die
yeah.
by the end, especially if they know their Hamlet. But We're very much aware that they are aware in your production, I think, that there's something is going to happen to them. And that you know, is more so, I think, in this case, in your production.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because certainly it seemed important. I mean, I suppose one way of looking at it is to make what may seem on the face of it a slightly simplistic distinction or definition of comedy and tragedy, which is, you know, in comedy... is when something is happening to a character. It starts acquiring a tragic dimension when that character becomes aware of what is occurring to them, and that's the thing that lends the play a kind of quite profound melancholy, even as it's, you know, having enormous fun with a sort of, you know, an anarchy of language, the fun of language, and you know, end of the pier humor, and you know, physical gags, and all the things that are part of the show. I think that it's an overused word, but that Beckettian sense of two characters who are travelers who never seem to be able to, and they can't remember where they came from, and there's a darkening sense of where they may be going, but there's no escape from this place. Is something very potent in the play.
Mm. Well, Beckett, Waiting for Godot, of course, had been seen in London for the first time about 12 years before that, hadn't it?
Absolutely.
But it was still very, very current, very much talked about.
Yes, and I mean, I think you know, it was quite early on. Obviously, the comparison with Tom's play and the influence of Beckett was made. I mean, I think it was made as early as Ronald Bryden when he
first reviews
mentioned this. And I think, as with everything, that's both it's true, and it's both you know, a helpful remark, but it also can be a misleading one, in the sense that, you know, Beckettian can often sort of mean something. I mean, I personally, I think wrongly, but in people's minds, as being sort of essentially sort of a little arid, perhaps a little nihilist, and you know, is that the nature of Tom? Well, of course, Tom's play is full of a kind of incredible joy and mischief, you know, about the nature of the theatre, about humanity itself. But I say this only because of the, as it were, the barnacles that attach themselves to writers over time, which are not necessarily useful when one's approaching the writers themselves. You know, like the barnacle that attaches itself to Tom's that he's dazzling. You know, the barnacle that attaches itself to Beckett, you know, is that he's existentialist, you know. And I mean, one of the sort of odd tangential connections here is that I was briefly an assistant to Samuel Beckett when he was directing Waiting for Godot.
Must have been quite an experience.
That was an extraordinary experience. And, you know, there's one thing, you know, that was clear from, you know, that proximity to Sam at the time was, first of all, the fantastic sense of mischief and humour in him.
Yeah. And well, there's a lot of music hall, actually.
A lot of music hall. And so, you know, that aspect of Beckett, you know, I think is also profoundly reflected, you know, in Tom's play. And then again, of course, he is his own man in every way, Tom. And, you know...
Well, the early reviewers also mentioned Beyond the Fringe in the same breath, didn't they?
Which actually is a tradition in many ways, you know, of the British theatre, that it has long put together these elements. You know, Tom's not the only one to do it, but it's long contained, you know, both elements of Beyond the Fringe, of music hall, of comedy, as a means of addressing, you know, very serious subjects. I mean, one has to think of, you know, what Joan Littlewood did. Stratford East, with that company of comedians. In my 20s, I was in East Berlin working there in the mid to late 80s. And of course, you know, that's the home of Brecht's great theatre, the Berliner Ensemble. And
who visited this theatre?
Who visited this very theatre in 56, I think it was, wasn't
and
it?
In the 60s they came as well.
In the 60s, right. Yeah. So, you know, I was very fortunate because it was Barbara Brecht, Brecht's daughter, who invited me to go there and work there in my 20s. And, of course, you know, one of my great revelations to me, you know, on encountering many of these actors who Brecht himself had brought into the company, although they were kind of much older by that time, is that almost to a man and woman, they were clowns. So I'm saying that tradition of holding comedy, you know, in the theatre as a, you know, as a central kind of vessel to express very serious things is something that I think is very alive in the British theatre. I have to say, it's in Pinter. I mean, you know, No Man's Land has a whole sort of brilliant sort of riff about Bunty at Oxford that could have come directly out of some sort of music hall sketch. And I know, you know, Harold, who I was very close to for a while and indeed directed in his own play, No Man's Land, was also profoundly influenced and admiring of Beckett. So there's a sort of mischievous telegraph wire of a sort of hidden kind of musical song that connects some of these writers together who one might actually think are very, very different.
Well, you have these two very young men, Joshua Maguire and Daniel Radcliffe. Did you have to do a lot of work in rehearsal about the double act and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, actually not really, oddly enough, in terms of, you know, self-conscious work on it, because, but the thing that took the longest was finding the two of them to play these parts, because I knew, you know, obviously from the beginning that it had to work like a double act, but you know, there's another quality that, in fact, I was talking to Tom about this some weeks ago, which is that you know, characters in famous plays acquire certain sort of qualities that they're presumed to need, or an actor's supposed to need to play. You know, like Romeo is the obvious example of saying, oh, it's got to be a really good-looking hunk of a guy with a whatever. And actually, the truth is that that's not the most important quality that a Romeo needs to have. The most important quality he and Juliet needs to have is that they are evidently fundamentally decent people. And that is absolutely true of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that unless there's something about the two of them that you feel, you sense, you know, to be fundamentally decent, there's no play and there's no tragedy. There's just simply, you know, a couple of smart asses up there kind of trying to be cleverer than we are, which is the last thing Tom wants to be. And so actually finding the two actors who could occupy those two dramatic spaces took a long time. I had no idea until, because Joshua Maguire was in my crosshairs quite early on after meeting, as I just
said. He has played Hamlet, of course.
Yes, and he's, you know, extraordinary. I didn't know Daniel, except obviously in the way that, you know, we all know Daniel, and so it was important to meet. And then, you know, I ended up spending a couple of hours with Josh and Daniel in a room in New York, because I was there and very... you know, graciously, they both flew there and we spent a couple of hours together, and I realised that they had a natural connection. And then I found out that in fact they were friends. That nobody had said that to me, and they hadn't, you know, and I thought, oh well, that's actually very helpful, because you know, they like each other. But you know, one of the most striking things too was my sense of Daniel as somebody who was so sort of generous and giving in the room with Joshua. I thought, that's interesting, because he feels like a natural Guildenstern, and yet, you know, on the face of it, you say, okay, Daniel is our, as it were, our one bona fide movie star that we have in the middle of this. But actually, Rosencrantz is, you know, in many ways, the sort of least dominant of
the straight
two.
Man.
Yeah, the straight man. And I was very interested by that and thought, oh, that's just right. And then there was a day in rehearsal where Dan sort of, I know he's completely confirmed that in this most wonderful way, when I was talking to him about both of them, actually, about certain moments, you know, that we're racing on there where we really need to kind of put the brakes on and be clear on this point and whatever, you know. And Daniel suddenly said, oh yeah, I don't want to miss that, because actually that bit contains my favourite line in the whole play, and that line was, I'm only good in support. Well, there we have it, you know. So it was a long-winded answer, but actually, you know, a double act sort of does rely on a certain chemistry between two people.
And generosity.
And then it's you know, they're both funny. They know what that is, and you know, and off we went. So it wasn't like I had to kind of work in any sort of solemn series on that aspect. It was really tracking. Well, actually, those places which Tom brought up, it was very interesting. You know, he said, "Oh, I can." The Guildenstern and the Rosencrantz—they're two. Both these guys are like in this perfect place, as you know, as Guildenstern and Rosencrantz. But remember, sometimes Rosencrantz sort of morphs into Guildenstern and Guildenstern morphs into Rosencrantz, so it's not like there's always just one dominant man, and that's the and that was very interesting, because you know, that sort of switch, you don't usually get that in the, you know, we talk about Rosencrantz being a straight man, but actually sometimes Guildenstern becomes a straight man, and Rosencrantz goes off on some extraordinary riff, and that ground is shifting all the time. And so that was something that we worked very hard at.
Well, you mentioned the importance of theatre in it, of course, and in your production, the player is phenomenally important. David Haig makes him an outrageous, ebullient character. People have described as having come off the Pirates of the Caribbean or something because of his long hair. But he is extremely funny and very dominant. So clearly you cast him because you knew he could do that.
Well, I sensed he could. I mean, you know, again, going back on talking about mounting this production from the beginning, you know, Tom had said to me too that he said it'd be great to have a player that we don't necessarily expect, and that wasn't because, you know, Graham Crowden played it originally, and it wasn't because, you know, Tom didn't think that was brilliant, which he did. It's just that after all these years, you know, I think the point was that we were looking for somebody who wasn't necessarily your obvious kind of, you know, Henry Irving, kind of actor manager, 19th century kind of bombastic character. And I knew, of course, that David Haig, you know, is a brilliant actor. You know, he's just one of those naturals and so extraordinary, and also a brilliant comedic actor. And when we met, you know, David was the first person to say, it is what you kind of really need, a sort of Henry Irving, you know, acting method, whatever. And I said, no. And he went, oh, thank God for that, because I don't think I could do that one. And then he said, but I don't know. But that aspect of it, that is a sort of little bit of a second-hand car salesman, you know, about it, you know, from Essex. I said, I'm just wondering if you could see your way clear. I said, you're talking my language here, David, because in many ways, and my way of saying it was that I love this reinvent, because I sort of think the player, in so many ways, is this brilliant kind of, he's really who I would sort of want Shakespeare to have been, you know, with that kind of great, but not the Shakespeare of the home counties, you know, the Shakespeare who is like part snake oil salesman and then inexplicably takes you on a sublime level into something profound about humanity, but is equally at home with, the basis instincts that are possible.
Absolutely.
And that seemed to me to be completely Shakespearean, you know. So
it's because he's touching up the young actor.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there was this, and so David sort of created this extraordinary creature, which was sort of Shakespeare from Essex.
Yeah.
And I actually that's part of the beauty of it, which is that he is incredibly funny, but so extraordinarily, you know, ushers death, you know,
yes,
onto the stage.
Well, they're called the tragedians, aren't they? And
they are.
And in fact, there is a sort of sense of tragedy about them because they're lost as well.
They are lost, and I mean, that obviously had a great effect on how we conceived of how those players themselves should be, you know, David at the head of the troupe, because I was... And again, you know, we didn't really want to go down the line of it just being sort of a jolly band of sort of Elizabethan, you know, players with whatever. So we knew that we needed to find a language and an identity for them. And there was something about that sort of Fellini-esque sort of La Strada, that feel of a world that is slightly unworldly, unearthly, that seemed very important. And that's how that kind of sort of... there was one critic referred to them as being almost boneless. That quality of unworldliness about them all, you know, emerged. Mm. And David just understood that so deeply, and they bonded very quickly as a consequence. You know, because they all kind of knew where they were. And then Corin Buckridge, who wrote our music, was like from the beginning. I mean, he knew that, because there's something that's a little bit, Kurt Weill-esque, but also a little Nina Rota about the sound they make with the clarinets and the saxophones when they come on. You know, it's not kind of faux Elizabethan William Byrd or anything. You know, so. And I remember the very first time Corin was teaching them that music, we were all in the rehearsal room and we were sort of, as is my wont, I was sort of mixing it all up when they were learning music, but they were also kind of wandering about with the car and doing various exercises and stuff. And they started playing this tune and Tom just said, it's just the way death suddenly comes on. I love this. And I thought, well, good, that's important, because that's what it is. And then, of course, they turn out to be, you know, hugely funny in a odd, bewildered way.
And the set also plays into this, doesn't it? Anna Fleischl.
Anna Fleischl, yeah.
We've got clouds on flats, and you could be anywhere or nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have this theatre stage curtain which comes across. So we are in limbo, but we're also very much in a theatre.
Absolutely.
So all at the same time.
All at the same time. I mean, the painted sky ceiling and the infinity curve that it goes back to at the end, you know, there was
right to the back of the old
Vic. Both Anna and I kind of felt almost instantly that there had to be at some level an implication of infinity somewhere on our stage, and then of course the tension between that and intimacy became a massive spatial challenge. So that's why we ended up building the stage also out to the audience, because in the old Vic, being on the proscenium line or just downstage of it is a hugely different place to being above the proscenium line. In fact, it's almost like the difference between a kind of long wide shot and a close-up, you know, these things are. So there was an interplay between intimacy and infinity going on all night. But the painted sky, again, I mean, you know, it came out of thinking about, an Elizabethan painted theatre and a painted sky, and you know, the presence of certain theatre elements like those curtains, like those lights, because as the player says, you know, the theatre itself is capable of it's a beautiful phrase, isn't it? To crack the shell of mortality, to actually, through artifice, penetrate something deeply true about humanity that more familiar realism or real life doesn't approach. And so it was an emotional landscape we were after, not a conceptual one, yes. If you know what I'm saying.
Yes, because they are in a particular play, they are very particular people, invented by Tom Stoppard, but they're also all of us, aren't they? They represent humanity. Ooh,
absolutely, humanity.
We're all lost, not knowing what's going to happen to us and when we're going to die specifically.
Absolutely, and that is I think that's the sort of great beauty of the play, which is that, you know, ultimately it is a fantastic, song of life and death. And you know, like, again, going back to Beckett, you know, the extraordinary thing about Waiting for Godot is that he made a play out of two people with absolutely, apparently, no forward motion whatsoever, created a drama about that. And then Tom Stoppard with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, who frequently, as Hamlet sweeps, the play sweeps across the stage and sweeps off stage to continue on sort of elsewhere, and they're left sort of hanging like these kind of sort of rather sad kind of... were kind of like carousels, like wind chimes just hanging in the air, and sort of, you know, what was that? Actually, I remember saying one day, you know, and this was to do with treating the Shakespeare very differently from treating Stoppard, as it were, the language, you know, and so that the ear would feel the change, you know. In other words, the first full Shakespearean scene, you know, when they come on and Claudius, you know, tells them what they're there for, and Gertrude speaks, and then, you know, Polonius arrives and speaks to the ambassadors, and they sweep off to see the ambassadors, and then there's a pause, and then the next line you hear is Rosencrantz saying, "I want to go home," and it's such a brilliantly kind of deflationary line in relationship to what you just heard. And so we were talking about this, and I also said, but actually there's also a really quite a profound rhythmic thing going off here, because with Shakespeare you've got a ticking clock. You know, it's driving on. It's hurtling, actually, despite Hamlet's delay. Well, it's hurtling towards a conclusion, which is that, and Shakespeare's theatre is inherently transitive in that way. It's always very, very active. When you come to the modern theatre, I mean, particularly, you know, post Beckett, you know, you suddenly there's no tick to the talk. There's just a talk. You know, and as soon as Shakespeare's plays, and you go, oh, tick tock, tick tock, tick tock, and then talk. And so that was a very interesting kind of rhythmic discovery. It was part of the fun we had, you know, with language in the rehearsal.
Yes, because I don't know if it's Stoppard himself who said it's not really about language, it's about situation, but it is about language.
It is about language as well. I mean, at one point, Guildenstern himself says, you know, when Rosencrantz says, you know, what's the matter with you? What are you playing at? And it's words. It's all we've got to go on.
Well, in the very first page of the script, you've got a play on the word game, haven't you? Mm-hmm. Immediately you go into games about games.
Yes, you do. And I mean, I think, you know, that there is anyway in Tom's work, as we know, a joy about language itself, you know, and these words that collide like bumper cars and then sort of go off and form more collisions and resonances and possibilities. And I mean, there's no doubt, you know, that language as the sacrament of the theatre really is something that, you know, becomes of itself something that the implication is makes us human and gives us history, you know, and you can't avoid it. And plus, you know, it requires a, on a practical level, a high degree of definition and clarity, you know, with it.
It's still great fun anyway.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
No, I mean, and it must be, and that's the joy. In fact, I think I said to the company on day one, you know, above all, we're engaged in an entertainment. But you know, I recall when we did Arcadia, which of course grapples with some, you know, pretty complex mathematical problems, and you know. And among other things, you know, the second law of thermodynamics. But I remember saying to the company at that time, you know, what's important here is not the cleverness of the idea. The thing that's transmitting as theatre is a kind of innocence in the sense of the passion to know. Is the thing that communicates, you know, and it's not as if we're trying to give an audience a lecture about the second law of thermodynamics, or that, you know, and Tom, I think, would absolutely agree with that, because he sees his first, well, he has said to me, you know, I see my first duty is the duty to entertain. And of course, you know, that's one of those slyly, sort of slightly deceptive remarks that actually on further examination gets more complex and labyrinthine as you approach it. But
you've got to get them in first, though.
You've got to get them in first, and that's part of the joy. And so, you know, I was smiling because I just actually remember that day in Arcadia when and somebody, you know, because I said to Tom, well, Tom, do you want to explain, you know, for us the second law of thermodynamics, you know, upon which, you know, so much depends, you know, the move towards entropy and chaos and eventually an empty, silent universe and all the sort of massive things that stem from this. And he said, well, no, I don't really. And so, he said, basically the same law of thermodynamics is the reason why a teenager's bedroom doesn't get tidy on its own. And well, you know, who's going to mess with that as a way of describing it? It's kind of marvellous moments, you know, when you kind of understand that his... course, you know, his priority is the humanity of the thing, you know.
Well, this Hamlet going in and out, I mean, of course, you've got to have a very traditional looking production such as we probably don't see anymore, haven't you?
Yeah, you do. I mean, I think we, again, you know, with Anna and Lauren Alstein, who did our costumes for us, you know, we had quite a lot of fun with that because we knew that Hamlet couldn't just be in. Clearly, if one's going to do a Hamlet now, it's going to be inherently modern and modern dress probably, but that wouldn't work quite the same way for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
No.
So there had to be something. It needed a different kind of flair to it, but equally we knew that it shouldn't just be a kind of like dutiful, worthy museum piece of Elizabethan costumes and all of that. And so actually, there is a fantastical element about our Hamlet that's sort of simultaneously kind of old and new, but you know, with the sort of colours and the surprising lines and things that are resonant of a certain time. And in fact, it's quite interesting because I often think, you know, this is this problem with, you know, when people get very purist about doing, not that many people do anymore, but you know, purist about doing, you know, Shakespeare in period clothing, and you think, but that's not what the experience was for the audience, was it? Because for them it was modern clothing, you know, and they were so what are we up to? So anyway, in playing with those lines and everything, we, you know, but I was also very conscious of the fact, same thing with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern themselves, you know, that on the one hand didn't want to kind of wrap them up in something that was sort of so kind of, you know, period obsessed that one couldn't sort of, as it were, reach through it. So we came up with a tension, you know, between them.
Yes.
and
them off tights.
Yeah, let them off, absolutely, let them off tights. Very, very crucial. Because I just don't think we can tell them. And it just would have been impossible for them to sort of get, I mean, it's like putting a pane of glass in front of them and then asking the two actors to come through that in this day and age. But, you know, the thing is, you know, there is a line right at the end of the play which one needs to pay attention to, because it wouldn't work if you entirely modernised the Hamlet and model it. which is, you know, when Rosencrantz just is about to die, says, you know, the sun's coming up, or the earth is.
Yes.
He goes, as the latest fashionable theory has it, you know, and you go, oh yeah, of course, that's coming directly, you know, from an Elizabethan, isn't it? But that was, you know, it was interesting because, you know, yeah, one has to find a language every time one does these plays, but in the end, we just said, yes, we have to hold hands in a very dynamic way with the past.
Mm.
Not be the past, but to hold hands with it.
Mm. I think that's a wonderful note on which to end, so thank you very much,
David.
You're most
welcome.